Hello, hello, and welcome to Think Business Futures. I'm your host, Max Tillman. Coming to you from the studios of 2SER in Sydney, on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and right across Australia on the Community Radio Network. This program is produced in association with the UTS Business School, and each week we take a closer look at the numbers that make up the news. In the words of the world's most successful investor and the world's fourth richest man, Warren Buffett, there are only two rules to playing the stock market. Rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, don't forget rule number one. It's a simple system to live by, or at least it sounds like it, which may be the reason that over the lockdown, a large number of Australians have dusted off their calculator, recited greed is good into the mirror in the morning, and entered the world of day trading. It may be a dangerous hunting ground for the average punter, but that hasn't deterred many from trying to make a quick buck between the breakneck speed of peaks and troughs in the COVID economy. Associate Professor Gerard van Deventer from the University of Technology Sydney's Business School is currently working on a deeper study into whether these investors are playing to win or bound to lose. Thanks for joining us. We now live in a brave new world of the ergonomic chair, the Zoom meeting, and the home investor. In Australia, as you mentioned in your article, retail investors were net buyers of $9 billion worth of Australian stocks between late February and mid-May. In contrast, the professional institutional investors, so the super funds and the like, were net sellers of $11 billion of stocks. So just to start off the conversation, why are retail investors, the smallest fish in the food chain, not following the lead of larger firms?
Max, I mean, it's an interesting point, and we've certainly seen a huge interest from retail investors, from small investors. So in other words, let's just call them the general punters in the street that are really been drawn to the market by through the whole kind of media information flow that we've seen around COVID. I mean, everybody was witness if you either get your news on the internet or on the evening or morning breakfast news. We would have seen that the markets had collapsed and had gone down, you know, quite a considerable bit due to the COVID pandemic. And so it's really been where people have been stuck at home and have constantly had the internet on and the news on. They've really been kind of following the story and have seen this as an opportunity, I think, for many people to participate in the market.
So is this a similar instance to what we had at the very beginning of the lockdown, where there were a lot of different ways to pass the time circulating online? A lot of people got into baking banana bread, for example, but it was certainly a sort of herd mentality to finding a way to pass the time. Now, obviously, there's a big distinction between baking some banana bread and trading on the stock market. But do you think that the practice was maybe normalized and the risks involved were diluted by the media?
Certainly. You've also got to remember, Max, one of the biggest things is that we are, as humans, we are driven by emotions, right? And one of the big kind of emotions that drive us is certainly when it comes to finances and many other aspects of our life is what we call FOMO, fear of missing out. And I think in a lot of instances where there was a number of stories where people would hear of friends or colleagues. So remember, people are sitting at home, right? You don't have a boss looking over your shoulder and seeing what you're doing on the internet when you're working at home. Then you hear stories of friends that have bought shares when the market went down and you certainly see the reports in the media. The emotions of, as I said, the fear of missing out has caused a lot of people to flock to the market.
You've obviously been observing the market itself and these retail traders, mum and dad investors, as you call them. What sort of stocks are popular with the average retail investor? Is it the simple blue chip stocks that everyone knows about, or is the average trader a little bit more diverse in their pickings than we maybe otherwise assume?
Look, interesting enough, and that raises a very interesting question, because you would assume that the average retail investor, so let's just say that the person that has never really participated directly in the market, I mean, keep in mind that most of us have, through our superannuation funds, most of us have a, call it an indirect exposure to the financial markets. But there's not that many percentage-wise people that have participated in the market by actively trading or buying or holding shares. What has happened is that if you don't have a deep understanding of the market and the complexities of the market, then people tend to gravitate towards shares that that they would know, that they recognize from being in the public. So shares, for example, that were extremely popular, people would just simply look at a graph and go, oh, this share fell quite considerably. So you're talking about a typical example would be shares like Qantas or Flight Centre. And a typical scenario that I think had played out for many people was that they'd look at a share like Qantas, who at one stage was trading before COVID, I think at about $7, round about there. Fell down to about $3. I think it's trading about $3.60 at a bit of a pickup over $4. And people would simply look at a graph, not really understanding the financial markets, and go, Qantas is going to come back when there's a vaccine for COVID. And if it goes back to $7 and I buy it $2. So, I mean, long answer to your question, I think it was mostly in very recognizable shares where people would go, we all know the banks, we know Qantas, we know Flight Centre. Well, some of the kind of more obscure stocks were probably neglected.
Do you think that there's a very simple, rudimentary understanding of the cyclical nature of markets that the average investor doesn't understand, and they may be picking up a stock with the assumption that that value is going to grow? There doesn't seem to be a quick fix for the airline industry anytime soon. So instead of maybe hedging your bets on a vaccine, do you think people should start potentially looking into industries that have a roadmap out of COVID-19 that isn't entirely dependent on outside variables?
Max, a really good question. I think, well, first of all, we've got to understand, you know, let's just take a step back. It's important to understand that the financial market is really much more complex than simply just looking at a chart, seeing that prices are low compared to a historical average, and then buying and then hoping that the share price would go up. I mean, it simply doesn't work that way. If you are going to be participating in the market, unless you're a professional trader, that you should really be in it for the long haul. Of course, that's what a lot of listeners would look at this and go, well, what's the danger behind this, right? What's the issue in picking shares and then, you know, hopefully making some money and selling it later and selling it in a few days or a few weeks from now when the economy recovers or the airlines would recover, et cetera. But there's an inherent danger in that. If you're not a professional trader, if you don't do this for a living, because keep in mind, a lot of people do this for a living and still do really badly at it. So if you don't do this for a living, you've got really, you should be very careful of trying to profit on the short term by second guessing which industry is going to do better. So there's really two issues. The first one is the long term. I mean, you should really be looking at the financial markets as a long term investment. And if any of the listeners out there have taken some money, did some homework, put some money into the stock exchange, and you believe that you want to keep that money for 10 or 20 years, that's probably a wise decision to make. But if you were simply just participating for a short term gain, well, in essence, that's no different than just simply gambling. So yeah, it is gambling and it's dangerous.
The Australian Securities and Investments Commission, they've analysed the retail investor trading. It shows from February 24th to April 3rd, the retail investors' daily buying and selling of stocks was double that of the months before. Now, more than 20% of that activity is from new or reactivated accounts, which I find particularly interesting. So those new accounts to the outside eye are a sign that the lockdown and obviously job or significant hour losses have put people in a position where they're willing to actually take these risks. So that 20% that we're talking about here, that 20% who have either re-entered the market through a reactivated account or are long-time listeners, first-time callers, are they in it for the thrill or is it really more a much-needed revenue stream during a hard time?
We're in the midst of doing some research in kind of unpacking exactly what the rationale is. By simply looking at the increase in numbers, there could be various reasons. We know that one of the biggest concerns that we had was with the superannuation withdrawal. One of the biggest concerns was, and it was now in the news this week, that there's some evidence to show that the withdrawal of superannuation was not all spent on essential items, but some of it was potentially spent on kind of on retail, which is not essential. Withdrawing money from your superannuation, that is certainly one of the contributing factors. As I mentioned, people's fear of missing out, fear of, you know, missing out where you hear stories of people gaining, people being bored. In the hypothesis we put out in our article on the conversation that we wrote was that we've got to remember when the lockdowns happened for the first time across Australia a few months back, we had all the pubs and clubs closed down. So there was no gambling allowed in person. There were no sporting events except horse racing that, you know, was the first to come back. But gambling, in essence, had disappeared. So one of the biggest dangers, of course, that we worried about was that people would simply view this as gambling. That's what ASIC is worried about. I mean, ASIC is worried about 20% of people opening up new accounts. And you're talking about kind of these apps, so typically like a kind of a ComSec type app that somebody would open up. Now, if you're in it for the long haul and you do the homework and you know what you're doing and you buy, you know, conservatively, kind of spread out your risk, that's fine over a long term. But I think what they're worried about is this kind of gambling notion on the short term. That's really the concern.
Maybe the regulation isn't necessarily up to speed with the demand for day trading, or is the system fine as it is?
It's a whole issue around technology. I mean, technology's made it very easy for us. And I'm by no means negative about it. I mean, it's fantastic. It is really good that you have access to be able to, you know, just simply through an app buy and sell shares. It makes it really easy. The trading cost has come down. It's a wonderful opportunity to participate in saving. But again, I base my view on the fact that if you really genuinely want to be saving money for a long-term goal, and if you get proper advice and you know what you're doing, and you put your money, for example, in an exchange-traded fund or whatever suits your risk profile, then it's fine. The flip side to it is because it's so easy, it's then easy to day trade. And by day trading, we mean where you would want to buy shares today and a few hours later, you'd want to sell the shares at a profit. And again, I want to emphasize, Max, if you're just an average punter, just, you know, normal 9-to-5 job, and you do this on the sideline, that's dangerous because this is the professionals. This is who you're up against, and you're trying to second guess what the market is going to do.
I can imagine that many stockbrokers would be quite pleased with the fact that there's now the added variable of a bunch of people who potentially don't really know what they're doing. Does it make the job of a professional stockbroker even easier because all they've got to do is make sure they go where everyone else isn't?
Yeah, the contrarian view. Yeah, I mean, our concern really is not for the welfare of stockbrokers, but for the welfare of society in Australia. So yeah, that might very well be true. But I mean, at the end of the day, what we're concerned about in our article and what we allude to is we're concerned about the average, you know, just the average person that is on the other side of the trade, somebody that thinks that they can second guess the market, that thinks, well, I'm going to put $10,000 on this stock and, you know, hopefully it'll recover because we'll have a vaccine and then you lose that money. I mean, we work hard for our money. So our concern really is for the welfare of individuals as a society. I mean, that's where our main issue lies in the kind of warning signs that as a society, we shouldn't be gambling. We should be responsible in our trading on the stock exchange.
Mm. And the motto, obviously, buy low, sell high. You can imagine why so many amateur investors are making their move during the pandemic when so much of what we see and experience is at a low. But your research has drawn a particularly interesting link between the day trading and gambling, which you've already alluded to. Now, between late March and late April, the Alliance for Gambling Reform, who we actually had on the program a few weeks ago, estimated gamblers saved more than $1 billion on poker machines and pubs as everyone shut up shop. Now, how much of a crossover between conventional gambling outlets and the day trading world have you observed?
There's a strong connection, and therefore the kind of theme of our article. I mean, we put forth multiple reasons of why people have started to participate in the market. As you mentioned, that 20% increase in new accounts or reactivated accounts. And as I said, you know, the angle we took, one of the hypotheses is the fact that people have now taken to gambling on the stock exchange because the gambling avenue wasn't open to them. So there's certainly a crossover. I mean, there's an argument, right, Max, which is quite interesting, and this is in a discussion discussion with my co-authors, and what we'd certainly kind of more of a philosophical argument is that, look, if somebody's going to be gambling, you know, would we rather not as a society want somebody to gamble by buying shares on the stock exchange than gambling by putting money in a poker machine? Is it really that bad if people are using the stock market to gamble? I was certainly not saying yes.
Lesser of two evils?
I mean, you know, we know, look, gambling is a very, very serious issue in Australia, right? I'm not an expert on gambling, and I don't have the gambling statistics, but I think anecdotal evidence suggests that gambling and the issues around, and of course, there's a lot of kind of issues for society around gambling and socioeconomic issues around gambling. And you know, as I said, again, a kind of philosophical argument, if you take a step back and say, well, isn't this better if somebody rather puts money on a stock exchange and rather puts money in an investment, even though the, you know, we'd prefer that they do it over the long term, that's better than putting money in a poker machine. So there is that argument to take into account as well, which I think is an interesting argument.
Do you think that there's an element of classism to this debate? Because do people believe that gambling money on stocks is a better class of wagering money as opposed to betting it on horses or football teams?
Yeah, it could very well be, right? And this is an argument that we hear regularly. What's the chances of you losing all your money, right? So there's that kind of risky side to it too. I mean, we know it's high risk, but if you go to a club and you put, you know, $1,000, and you can easily gamble and lose everything. But if you put $1,000 in the stock exchange, what's the chances of literally losing everything if you diversify it across a number of shares? And the chances are obviously less than losing all your money. So there is a difference between them. There's a difference in multiple aspects between them, and that's what you alluded to is one of them as well. Yeah,
Day traders in the modern era a little bit more astute. The cult of the personality that has existed around financial and tech CEOs over the last decade, the self-made millionaire, the financial advisor, these things have certainly taken off considerably during the age of social media, in which you have a lot of people from all walks of life telling you the benefits of financial autonomy, taking decisions into your own hands. Do you think that that has an influence on the decision by so many people to no longer trust their superannuation funds or their personal stockbroker to make decisions in their best interest, but to in fact do them on their own?
You know, if you go back again, you know, 20, 30 years, if you were to be considered a day trader as a kind of an amateur day trader, I mean, where would you get your information from? You'd read the newspaper. And by the time you read something in the newspaper, it's too late, and the market would probably have reacted to that information when it was released. Nowadays, information is instantaneous, right? So as soon as the RBA, for example, makes a decision on interest rates, the average punter sitting at home with access to the internet can get that information exactly the same time as a professional trader do, bar kind of any inside information. So obviously that reaction to that or the information is instantaneous, which makes it much easier for us to trade. So making it easier to trade, and then added to it the fact that we now have access instantaneously also to how our superannuation is doing. Now, Max, it's an important thing that you mentioned is people don't trust necessarily their superannuation. You can open up, and that's the thing. You don't have to wait for a quarterly report or a half-yearly report. You can just go online, and you can see how your superannuation fund is doing. And I mean, the problem, again, it comes down to human emotion, right? So I go and I log on to my superannuation, and I see my superannuation, for example, let's go back, let's put myself in the position of April, right? So I see my superannuation has lost 20% in value. And then my neighbor next door has bought, shares in Qantas, or, you know, if you use Qantas a few times, any share in the market, and your neighbor over a cup of coffee tells you, socially distancing coffee, tells you, oh, I've just made 20%. And you think to yourself, my superannuation, I'm paying fees on this, but I've got my neighbor who knows nothing about trading has just made a 20% profit. Well, why should I be listening to and putting my money into my superannuation? That's kind of a lot of it, Max, has been driven by emotions, you know, fear, greed, et cetera, over the last couple of months.
Now, for millennial day traders, there's a palpable shift in how blue chip stocks in, obviously, the classics, mining, banks and industry are viewed. And in fact, the Herald had an article a few weeks ago referring to boomer stocks, which is how millennial day traders refer to those classic blue chips. Now, they prefer to delve into penny stock trading, which is obviously prices in the cents rather than the dollars. So there's clearly less financial barriers to entry. But these young investors don't seem to fit into that mum and dad investor model that you talk about. So is there much of a distinction in how millennials and baby boomers trade online?
Yeah, look, they certainly, and I mean, throw in there, I mean, there's a couple of generations that you also got to throw in there, Generation X and Generation Z, right? So, I mean, we certainly see some different patterns. I think one of the things, I mean, besides the kind of shorter term day trading, there is certainly a real drive from millennials to, in general, in terms of investment, to really be concerned about if you're taking a longer term view in terms of what exactly is the company that you're investing in doing, for example, in the ESG space, environmental, social, and governance space. So we certainly see that as a big drive. Not to say that, for example, baby boomers or Generation X neglect that area, but we certainly seen, you know, one of the things that millennials have been doing is certainly, you know, questioning, looking at things a little bit more thoroughly from an ESG space. Getting to the point, so that's kind of a big observational difference, I think, that we find in terms of longer term. Shorter term, what is called the penny stock, penny reference to the American 1 cent, but penny stocks are stocks where the big appeal of a penny stock, so something, say, for example, a stock trading at like 5 cents a share, as opposed to a share trading at $20 or $30 a share. A penny stock, the big appeal in that is if I buy a share at 5 cents a share, and the share goes up to 10 cents, I've basically doubled my money. And so you look at it and you say probability of it going from 5 to 10 cents is pretty high, as opposed to buying a share for $20 and then hoping that the share will increase to $40, making the same. So I've got to put in a much bigger outlay to get the same percentage. So that's the appeal of these penny stocks. So irrespective of generational differences, there's always been an appeal for them in day trading in terms of just making, because I started a lower base, a bigger potential profit. So that's the big difference.
But a day trader is almost the canary in the coal mine for any major crashes in stock prices. And would major firms be watching their results very closely for any signs of what's to come?
Yeah, I mean, that is interesting because, there's usually what people tend to do is we tend to look where the kind of the smart money is, right? And it's usually better to invest where the smart, I mean, that's a theory, right? Is to say, what I'm going to do is if I'm going to invest, I'd rather invest where the kind of Warren Buffetts of the world. I mean, Warren Buffett for the listeners out there would know is, you know, one of the most successful investors of all time at Berkshire Hathaway. So people kind of tend to, well, if Warren Buffett does this, and because he tends to take these longer term views, and so the what you'd mentioned is really what we're careful of is this herding behavior. And, you know, then the general perception is, well, if everybody is buying it, well, that's just herding, right? The herding is something where we've got to be careful because that's our pyramid schemes are basically become popular, right? And if you buy into a pyramid scheme when everybody else is doing it, you know you're going to lose your money soon. I'm not implying stock exchanges anywhere near a pyramid scheme, but if everybody buys into this, then it's a time to get out.
Well, longevity is the key, and if you're lacking that long-term vision, then maybe the risks of day trading outweigh the rewards. To return to Warren Buffett, if you aren't thinking about owning a stock for 10 years, don't even think about owning it for 10 minutes. And as Associate Professor Van Devender has shown over the last half hour, that might be worth remembering. So instead of trading away your money, Think Business Futures advises you just bury it in the backyard, or if you don't have one, under the mattress will do just as well. Make sure to catch the full show online wherever you are in Australia, and of course, make sure to stay safe. I've been your host, Max Tillman. Thanks for listening.